Pay the right amount of money.
Yep, pay the right amount of money and join No Driving Gloves. Check us out, buy us a coffee, check out the website, nodrivinggloves.com. You got Derek and I here tonight. We're going to be chatting a little bit about cars like we usually do. This time we're going to talk a little bit of work-life balance. And then we got a wonderful question from a listener earlier. And I told him we would address that probably, or try to address that tonight in the show. But we're going to push that off to the last three quarters of the show or so. A lot of so's there.
Yeah.
We doing okay, Derek?
Oh, doing great, John. Having a lot of fun in life. That's what it's all about, right?
Yeah. This topic came up because I think of your little weekend adventure. Are you recovering from that? This is show related, listeners. So
it is, believe it or not. I think I am recovering from it, although I do have two small children who may not allow me to recover appropriately. So
he's been on the kids all day.
Yeah, you would think they were the ones that traveled by the way they were acting today. They needed naps.
I need a nap. That comes, you know, when you really start thinking about your 401k or your ages start begin with a five, naps come in handy. It should be a standard requirement.
It's exactly what I was about to say. It's funny that when we're little tiny things, we need naps. And then when we get to middle age, we need naps. We get like 20 good years of no naps.
Yeah, but when you're younger, you never want to take them. Maybe that's the problem. We don't take enough of them when we're younger, so we make up for it when we're older. We're talking a little bit of life there.
We're talking about work, life, car fun balance tonight. So
yeah, I find that it is a delicate thing, this car life balance between time, passion, other hobbies, money, a job to support this. Oh, and family, where some of us just have a significant other and some of us have little minions running around too, which Despicable Me comes out, was that July 5th? They're not a paid sponsor, but kind of want to see Gru again. Is that on your list?
You know, to be honest, I don't pay enough attention and didn't know a new Minions movie was coming out.
Well, now you do. No excuses. Surprise the kids.
Hopefully he still has his cool jet car flying machine.
One of the ads shows them getting into a car. I can't tell you if it's a jet car or not. But I guess, do you want to enlighten us a little bit on what you did this weekend that kind of alluded or brought this topic up?
I certainly can, John. This has been, well, I should say half of this plan has been brewing for a little while, since Amelia Island, since the Amelia Island Concours, which I talked about going to back in, when was that? February, March timeframe, as I recall. So it's been a few months here. And half of this weekend was a bit unexpected. So part of the fun of the car life, car hobby life, right? So the plan for Memorial Day weekend, as it all laid together, was to head to Florida. Yes, just north of Miami, which is about 12 to 13 hours from Franklin, where I live.
That's kind of a good Memorial Day weekend. Head to Florida, hit the beach, do some swimming, some surfing. I guess you surf off the coast of Florida. I don't know.
Yeah, they surf down there. I'm not really big on one for wanting to go to the beach or water. So I do swim. I know how to swim. I know all that good stuff, but not the beach has never been for Derek. And then why do you go
to Florida over Memorial Day weekend?
Why else, John? To pick up cars, right?
Oh,
yeah. Yep. So kicking back to the Amelia Island Concours, which I said I talked about on the show, going down there, checking things out, all that. Well, what I didn't lead on to was that I was also going to look at a vehicle for myself while we were down there. And I made the trip from Amelia Island down to the Miami area to look at a 1910 Duryea buggy yacht. Now, that's probably not a vehicle that many of our listeners know exactly what it is. But just to give you a quick idea while you're there, already looking it up, because I know our listeners, it is one of the famed odd high wheelers of the early, late 19-aughts, early 19-teens. There was the high wheeler craze, especially in the Midwest. And the high wheelers were made for the dirt muddy roads of rural America. However, this just so happens to be produced by, in my opinion, and many historians' opinions, one of the most important automotive pioneers, pioneering brothers in U.S. automotive history, Charles Duryea. Charles and Frank, of course. Go ahead, John, because I know.
I was going to say, for our YouTube viewers, I just popped up a picture of the 1910 Duryea for everybody to see.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is the one I bought, proof and evidence by the fact that if you look very closely on top of the gray tub, the same hat I wear every week on the show is sitting on top of the tub. It was hot in Florida. I had to, change the idea of how I was clothes I was wearing, because at first it got very hot. As the listeners the YouTube viewers just saw, the one I purchased is what we would call a jigsaw puzzle. It is completely disassembled, down practically nut and bolt disassembled, and which of course made it a little more affordable on my end, talking about jobs to support hobbies. And went down to Miami to, I was able, between Amelia Island and Memorial Day weekend that just passed, to secure the purchase of the vehicle and plan a trip down to pick it up. Cool thing about it is timing worked out and it became a father-son trip. So that was a really cool benefit to it. Of course, my dad, as we've talked about many times on the show, one of my big influences in getting into the car hobby and learning a lot of what I know, being that he has a restoration shop back in Michigan. And so we had the good fortune of being able to make it a father-son trip down to pick up the vehicle. So that was kind of the long plan. Not necessarily knowing it was going to be Memorial Day weekend to go pick this thing up, but it had fallen into place over time. The unexpected part of Memorial Day weekend was an opportunity to pick up a car that a bidder backed out of in an auction I had been watching a few weeks ago. And the bidder backed out, and the people that were involved in the auction know me here in town and decided they would reach out and offer the car to me. So Thursday, literally hours before leaving for Florida, picked up a 1916 Chevrolet 490 touring car. So, and John just threw up a great picture of it here for our YouTube, or our folks watching. I keep saying listening, watching the podcast live stream tonight. And there's a little more beyond this, and I think John and I'll talk a little bit about it more. But I want to take a break here from talking and let John, give me a hard time for buying vehicles.
I'm not going to give you a hard time for buying vehicles. Like was discussed on our message boards, it's hard to hide money. And I mean, that just comes with the picture and rolls with the flow, I guess. I mean, there was, I've alluded to before on the podcast, October and about 05 when, I bought a trailer that came with a Caterham, and then I needed a truck to pull the trailer, ironically, up from Miami to where I was living in D.C. at the time. And of course, I was driving a lowered S10. So I sold that and bought a Dodge Dakota, drove down to get the Caterham, came back with the Caterham, and a week later sold my Stalker V6 in trade for a Lotus Europa. And I was kind of done then, because by the end of the month, a Lotus 110 bicycle became available, brand new in the crate in Switzerland. And I decided I didn't have the $8,000 to buy a chassis of a bike that I would hang on the wall, which will be a topic of an upcoming episode, Cars is Art. But
ooh, yeah.
So I can't knock you, but it does bring into that car life balance, because you chose to take your Memorial Day weekend away from the wife and the kiddos. Now, you did spend it with your father, and you said you had some interesting conversations and enlightening conversations on the trip. So, you know, you did get a little bit of the balance out of that. But it's a, you know, it's a toughest decision. And then you got the squeezing it in between work, and then squeezing in the cost of the trip, and doing it, cramming it all in. I mean, that, what is, how many miles was that for you? That's got to be 3,000 miles round trip, 2,500 miles round trip.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact, but you're close. It's 13 hours down. And then we had to go. There was some other, you know, work life involved in it, because I did pick up vehicles for the Lane Motor Museum while we were on the trip as well. So it became a work life major balance, because I was doing both. I was doing work and personal life all in one shot. So it became very interesting. I kind of figured the comment would come up from you and one of our avid No Driving Gloves community members about not being able to hide the money. And I believe I've addressed this on the show before. I have a certain number that when I'm purchasing cars, I very hard try not to go over. And it's a fairly low number in the car collecting world. Let's say it's only four digits. It's very low number. And I am proud to say that the combination of these two vehicles, purchasing two vehicles, did not put me over that number. So I think I got a great deal on the two vehicles. So,
You know, Bill Gates has got numbers for cars too. So, I mean, we all have a price that we're willing to pay. Yeah, not giving you a hard time. His, I know you get
his you have shop a lot like I do than mine.
you get, you know, you're always looking for a deal. And like I said, there's always cars on my list. And if the number hit, if I see one at a number, you know, I know what I'm going to pay for my next CRX SI. If one shows up at that price, I'm going to have a CRX SI. If one never shows up, I probably won't. Unfortunately, I don't adjust my wants for inflation. Oh, yep. And yeah, Jason, he might have drove by both of our houses. But to be honest, car life balance, and plus you throw in podcasting and you know, the job and that. I don't know if I could. I can't. Sean Yoder commented here, one of our former hosts of No Driving Gloves. I can't even find time to have dinner with Sean, and he lives 15 minutes from me now, and he probably drives within 2 miles of my house on a daily basis. And just trying to find that time to, you know, make everything work is just so difficult anymore. And while I joke that I don't do a lot with cars, I guess I really do a lot with cars, and trying to keep this podcast coming to you. And so, I mean, it's rough. You were, now that I'm done babbling, Derek, you can go where you were going.
No, that's all right. And you know, like you say, John, it's about the work-life balance, and it was Memorial Day weekend. You know, that's oftentimes a long weekend, right? For folks that are out there working, you get to take some time, be with the family, go to the beach, maybe, you know, whatever you do on Memorial Day weekend. But you know, also sometimes, you know, you have to make sacrifices in life for that work-life balance, and understand kind of what you're trying to do in a work-life balance. And this weekend really played into that for myself and, of course, the family, because one of the goals and ambitions, I think everyone that listens to the podcast maybe knows that, you know, I'm trained in objects conservation of historic vehicles and industrial type machinery. And, you know, I've been doing that kind of side work since about 2008. I've been taking on side projects with other museums, private collectors in, you know, proper preservation, care, conservation of historic vehicles. And I've just kind of been doing it loosely since 2008. But January of this year, we decided to, my wife and I, but that's the we, decided to form an LLC and kind of make it more of an official side hustle and make it more of an official side business for ourselves to operate and bring in some, you know, greater income into the household and the family. And so really these two vehicles play more into the LLC side, the side hustle side of the work-life balance and getting that company going. And making people more aware of what I can do. So, you know, the 1916 490 likely will not be with the private collection, my private collection, long, because really the goal with that vehicle is to get it back up into operational, running, driving, touring condition, and clean it up, make it look really good, and basically put it up for sale. Possibly at Hershey later this year is a possible goal. I've got to look at the calendar and sort out the time, but that's looking like it might be a goal for the first place to put it up for sale. And you know, John and I have been talking about a lot of things with the No Driving Gloves podcast, and I've got a couple ideas that I'm not going to quite let out yet that John and I are working on. But the 1910 Duryea buggy yacht is likely going to become a quick video series on the restoration of that, and likely will be part of the No Driving Gloves community. John and I are working on that, and it'll be kind of a look at how to, you know, take a vehicle like this that's in pieces, study it, understand how it was put together, how it was finished, do all the research to accurately restore it to what it would have been the day it came out of the factory floor. Including all the way down to brush painting the body rather than spraying it. So a lot of things in the future that we are all working on, John and I at No Driving Gloves, and of course the work-life balance, you know, here in Derek's world. So some cool things I think to look forward to with this these acquisitions that we're talking about on the show tonight, John.
Yeah, quickly hit that comment or question from Jason. Is the Duryea now your oldest vehicle? It's older than the Hotmobile, isn't it?
If it is dated correctly by the person who sold it to me, and it is a 1910, then yes, it would be the oldest vehicle in the collection now.
Is it the most disassembled?
And the most disassembled, yes. And I will say, you know, I started out by saying not a lot of people have probably heard of a Duryea buggy yacht. I've known about the Duryea brothers, Frank and Charles, for a long, long time. But I've known about the buggy yachts since I was a kid because Charles moved around a lot. After Charles and Frank broke up the Duryea Motor Wagon Company and went their separate ways and did their own things, Charles kind of bounced around having factories in different locations, building cars in different locations. And it just so happens that from, I think it was 1911 to like 1913, early 14, he actually moved to Saginaw, Michigan, of all places, and started a factory there to build his buggy yachts. So growing up as a kid, about 25 minutes south of Saginaw, Michigan, and being obsessed with automobiles, I was researching as a kid what vehicles were built in the area I grew up in. And of course, one of those were the Duryea buggy yachts. So I've always had a little hankering in my life, or, you know, a kind of a desire to have one of the vehicles that were built in Saginaw. Now, if this is a 1910, not likely to have been built in Saginaw. But if I, you know, figure out it is a later one than what it was dated as, you know, when the gentleman sold it to me, then it may be a Saginaw built Duryea buggy up. But right now I can track down 5, maybe 6 that are still in existence, counting the one I have. So it's very unlikely that I was going to find a Saginaw built one. So just the fact that it's a buggy yacht is pretty cool to me that I finally have one in my collection.
Now, to throw this interesting, the world's small, and it's kind of funny how things happen. I'm going to say I'm leading to a point here, but I believe I came up and visited you when you were at the Henry Ford, correct?
Correct, you did, sir.
And I believe in your conservation studio there was a Duryea.
That is correct, sir.
Now, to add to that, see how these Duryeas cross? Crazy car, nobody's heard of. You know, there might be 15 of these things on the planet, various models. I learned about the Duryea in the late 80s because Frank and Charles Duryea were born in Central Illinois. Mm-hmm. Charles Duryea incorporated the Duryea Motor Company in 1898 in Peoria Heights, Illinois. And of course, I grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and I learned about Duryea when I don't remember what the name of the museum was now. It's now at the Peoria Riverfront Museum. They have an 1898, so the earliest Duryeas, and I think it's one of three, the Duryea Motor Trap on display. And that's where I first initially learned about Duryea. Late 80s, cross paths with Derek in the early 2000s, see my first Duryea probably around 2010, 2011. And here we are talking about Duryea and Derek acquiring one, 40 years or so after I learned about Duryea. It's just kind of these funny things. And we always talk about how cars, you know, introduce us and, you know, that's how we meet people, but they keep us coming back for more and more and more. And yeah, it's just, Derek's talked about Duryeas for years, and I have always, you know, in the back of my mind, I go, oh, this is, I know the Duryea, and had some relation to where I grew up also. Now, I don't think I'll be adding a Duryea to my stable anytime soon or ever, but you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Henry Ford Museum, John, the one you're referencing, I was working on the Duryea trap that is in the collection there. It's on exhibit, a three-wheeled vehicle that they have that Charles Duryea built. And also in that collection is the only surviving of the first 13 built in 1896. That is the car that put the Duryea brothers on the map. Of course, they built their first car in 1893, built a few other one-offs along the way, and then in 1896, built the first serial production automobile in the United States by building 13 identical cars. And like I say, the only known survivor of those 13 is the one at Henry Ford Museum. So I've had the good fortune to work on the 1896 car a little bit and the Duryea trap that's at the Henry Ford, and now my own Duryea buggy yacht. So pretty cool. Jason's been itching to get this question in because he's asked it, I think, at least two, if not three times now. But why did the previous owner have it in such a disassembled state? Well, the previous owner, and I'm not going to mention any names, is a gentleman who has been connected to Duryea for quite some time, studied them for many, many years, did some really cool stuff with the Duryea vehicles. And this was just one that he found and had started a restoration on. And that whole work-life balance thing, he never got an opportunity to get it much further than the disassembled state. So he's now an older gentleman that is retired and living down in Florida, and has decided that it was time to move the vehicle on to its next caretaker. And I had the good fortune that that's me. So now it's my goal and my task as the caretaker of the vehicle to reassemble it and put it back on the road, so another Duryea can see, see the road, and people can see the Duryea again. So that's kind of what happened there, Jason.
And it'll make it easier to sell because it'll be in one piece, much easier to load onto the trailer.
Yeah, when you can drive them on, it's way easier.
No, I was watching Pickers the other night, and they were doing the same thing with a Porsche 356. Pull out the 356, get this part, find this part, find this part, find this part. And this was when a farm of 356s. I assume this guy didn't have more than one Duryea kicking around his building. But that, you know, that is what brought up the work-life balance. I mean, Derek invested his whole holiday weekend in it. He made the financial decision to purchase this Duryea. And by purchasing this Duryea, he's making a time commitment in the future to assemble this while he's in the process of growing this side hustle of his and investing money into purchasing a vehicle to help promote that side hustle and maybe help fund some more of that side hustle and adding a business to the mix in addition to work, in addition to his children and his wife and his father and all those other commitments and the side hustles that he may or may not have as present projects. I can't even keep track of them myself, and I talk to Derek quite often. So cars are fun, but you do have to eventually pull back. And I've alluded to, at my peak, and Derek's quickly approaching it, I own 13 vehicles. And sounds damn cool. Well, I got 13 cars. Until you realize then you've got to, at least I was in Virginia, and I've always said that, because you bought them so that you only had to buy one license plate a month instead of 13 in 1 month like you would if you were in Alabama and many other states. But 13 car insurance payments a month. You've got worrying about keeping them tagged, worrying about keeping them running, worried about keeping them stored. And that all takes time. And you don't realize it until you start selling them off. Then all of a sudden you start getting a couple hours back here and a couple hours back there. And that's why I don't have a huge collection. That's why I don't have project cars, because I have my, other hobbies and my other interest in just reading and learning history of cars, or playing with my 3D printers, or playing with my vinyl cutters, or playing, all this other stuff that I do around going to car shows, creating the second podcast around the Alabama car community. It's car related, but it's still finding that balance. And there's many days that my better half, you can kind of see it like, she's got her hobbies that I participate in, but they aren't my complete cup of tea, and she does the same for me. And it's always a fine line. And I'll be honest, I've screwed it up before. We all joke about, in this portion of the podcast, he was dating so-and-so, and in this portion of the podcast, he's dating so-and-so, and in this portion, I have long-term relationships, but they're not as long as some people, especially Jason and Sean and those that are in the chat room. I think even Phil popped in there, and I believe he's been with his wife for many, many, many years. And you want to talk about a guy with car life balance, he's constantly posting pictures of what he's doing with his rotaries.
So that's
we don't have
cool stuff.
Actually, he posted a picture the other day of, he stopped by the bookstore to see if they had an issue of some magazine. If you're out there, Phil, tell me what magazine that was, because his car's on the cover of it again this month. He's lived that dream multiple times, having featured cars on magazine car covers. John, what are my current car projects? We'll get into it in a little bit, but I actually spent $350 or so on parts for the Fiesta to save myself about $2,000 in labor. So that's tomorrow afternoon and Saturday. I'll be doing some deferred maintenance on the Fiesta. Not doing the big piece of deferred maintenance. If that piece fails, I'll have a Fiesta that I always thought about. Wouldn't it be cool to do a Fiesta ST? But keep in mind, I've got the four-door sedan. And I want to know, can I move the Fiesta ST pieces over to my four-door sedan and make it a four-door ST? Just one of these little crazy things. I doubt if I would ever ever do that. You know, Jason also alerted to talking about the small world, or mentioned here in the comments that he was listening to No Driving Gloves one day in his office, and somebody walked by and he heard my very distinct voice and stuck his head in, and the guy said, "Is that John?" And you know, Jason's, "Yeah, that was." That was a friend of mine from high school. Well, just after high school, I mean, around 20, 21 years old, used to go over to his house and party, cruise Main Street. That gentleman had, it's still one of the coolest car paint jobs I've ever seen. It was a 87 Monte Carlo SS that was this dark green on the roof that faded and then transitioned to a purple. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I don't think it would fly now. It was very late 80s, early 90s colors. But there's another car person 600 miles away. You stumble across them. But and Sean's encouraging me to do the Fiesta ST sedan.
Oh, I think you should. But yeah, you know, John. I want to jump in because you know, talking about your Fiesta brings in a whole other aspect of the work life kind of car balance, and you know. What we've been talking about so far on the show has really been more the hobby side of it, right? The fun side, the collecting the old cars and, or, you know, just your hobby car, your fun ride. And in your case, John, in what you're talking about right now with the Fiesta, that's just your honest to God work-life balance of needing to have a vehicle to drive to and from work, drive around, and have it be safe and mechanically, you know, kept up, maintenance done, and all of that. And that's starting to become harder and harder by the day. And it's a burden on many people to, you know, financially keep these vehicles up. And if you're not mechanically inclined and you don't know what parts cost, and you just trust the dealerships or the shops that you take them to, some of those places overcharge. They're finding ways to take money out of your pocket and make a bigger profit than, I mean, many of us in the field say is reasonable and disagree with. So, you know, what you're dealing with, John, is more of the true work-life balance and keeping just the general day-to-day going, not the fun hobby side of things.
Well, actually, because of the way I look at this, and people know I need my car for work. You know, I drive 3,000 to 4,000 miles a month. So I use this car as a tool. When I was telling my dad about what I was doing, he made the statement to me. He goes, "You'd do that work for somebody else if they came up to you and said they'd pay you $2,000 to do it." And I really thought about it and said, yeah, for what I'm doing. Yeah. It's kind of ridiculous that there's $2,000 in labor in doing this stuff. I mean, and what the shops charge. And I'm doing some analysis and research. We had a gentleman on a couple of years ago, Ed Kowalczyk. Unfortunately, he's passed away now, who helped explain labor rates in shops. And I want to talk to a shop owner and interview them and really break down a service ticket and how the prices and stuff come about. Because this estimate really threw me a loop, but I'm kind of excited also because, you know, we just got this new house and we're moving in and kind of, you know, you're at that point where there's still stuff to unpack. But I spent, you know, I had 4 days off this weekend and I spent all day Monday for sure and a good portion of Saturday putting the garage together. And the garage is all set up and I'll bring my toolbox over tomorrow afternoon with all of, you know, my Snap-on tools and my Craftsman professional tools and get that all loaded up. And that's probably going to be more of an effort than actually the work that I'm going to do to the car. But it's kind of exciting because those Snap-on tools have been in a box since literally the morning I walked out of the Barber Museum in January of 2019. So there's $30,000 of tools that I haven't touched in 5 years. And I'm kind of excited to do it and get dirty. And the parts arrived. I've been out of town all week and I came home to boxes of parts And the first thing I had to do, I had to do something, and I don't have many tools here. I got out my screwdriver and changed the air filter, and yeah, that kind of felt good. Now, we'll see how it is at the end when I get into the really difficult things. But it's, while it's not a collector car, and while it's just working on my daily driver, it's kind of exciting, and it's a neat feeling to do. And, you know, when I told my girlfriend that I was going to do it, she goes, "You know how to do all that?" I said, I can take a car completely apart and put it back together. I said, I can't diagnose the damn thing if it's broken, but if you give me the car, I'll take it all the way apart, put it back together, and the thing will be fixed because everything will be right. So it's just, and then somebody else in her circle of friends is going, "He can do that. He can do that. He's going to do this." And of course the fear is all of a sudden I'm going to get those questions. "Hey, can you do this?" And that person is a little bit frugal, we'll say. And I just don't want to do it for other people, but it's kind of fun because I'm not pressured because Jason just said, now we know who has the money because I got another car to drive. And that's what I did this week is, you know, I got to drive the Mini, and hey, the Mini's a pretty damn fun car. And it's an interesting alternative. I just don't like putting the miles on it. So I guess we get our fun in slightly different ways. I mean, Derek gets it with his historical research and wrenching on the old stuff in the garage and things like that. I normally get my fun out of researching and staying up on automotive trivia and all the things happening in the automotive realm. You know, that's how we get our topics, whether we're talking EV, whether we're talking excise taxes, whether we're talking Elon Musk, whether we're talking, you know, regulations, whether, you know, what this manufacturer is doing. That's what I enjoy, I guess, the book side of the car hobby, which is a little different, but, you know, that's the world I am now. I mean, after 20 plus years of wrenching on cars, I don't want to do it, you know, 9 to 5, 5 days a week anymore. But taking this break from life and probably spending 12 hours wrenching on a car, I'm good with that. And it, like I said, I'm looking forward to it, and it sounds like fun to me right now. It might not at the end, but
we'll have an update on that next week.
Yes, we will. Oh, I like putting miles on the Mini, Jason. I just don't want to put 3,000 or 4,000 miles on it a month. I bought the Fiesta 15 months ago, 16 months ago. So I bought it, I guess, 17 months ago. And I've put 62,000 miles on that. I'm really glad I didn't put 62,000 miles on my Mini because I've got significantly more money invested in the Mini. And if the Fiesta dies now, it paid for itself. The Mini would not have. So, you know, there's, again, car life balance. Now we're looking at the money and the money investment. You know, I go out and buy a $5,000, $6,000 car that I've put 60,000 miles on and done 4 oil changes, a set of tires. Under warranty, they did a transmission control module. And now I'm putting $350 of parts into it. So I've got, you know, less gas. I've got less than $7,000 into this car to drive 60,000 miles. And I would, you know, I would have more than that in depreciation on the Mini. And I would have a Mini that would be near the end of its usable life because it would be well over 100,000 miles itself. So again, that's the car life balance. I want to see what Jason's last word was supposed to be here. Are you keeping the miles T?
Yeah. Are you keeping the miles T? You don't know what that means?
No, I'm not keeping the miles for low resale. I'm keeping the here's an interesting story. Car life balance and my significant other, my girlfriend, would tell you. The whole reason she went out with me is because I had a Mini. And she was doing her online profile, or I can't remember. I think I reached out to her first. Then it's on, you know, I met her online, and some people pose with their dogs. For some reason, I had a picture of my Mini on there, and I also had a picture of my dog on there. But she said she always liked Minis, and she thought, you know, she'd at least be able to get a ride in one. And so that's what started our relationship. And if it was normally me, that car probably would have been gone. I've had that car, it'll be 3 years. Yeah, probably 3 years come July. And if not four, I'd have to really think about it. So it just kind of, yeah, it would be four come July. I never have a car 4 years. I would have gotten rid of it, but she kind of likes the idea of keeping it around. I believe actually in our conversation earlier, Jason was saying he's envious of the people that still have, and I kind of am too, the people that still have their first car, their car from high school, or this car when they got married, or from their first date with their wife. And she kind of likes that. And I kind of like that idea. But I also know how fragile BMWs and Minis are. And I just feel it's nice to use it when her and I are together at this point, and, you know, have a little bit of fun. And like, it's, you know, so it's not intentionally keeping the miles down. It's not it's not any more expensive to maintain than anything else. I mean, well, oil change on the Ford's $80, oil change on the Mini's $200, but, you know, I wouldn't say it's too expensive to maintain. It's just keeping the miles down so that the car has more calendar days on it. So there's Phil chiming in. He still has the car that he and his wife went out on a first date. Yeah. Dana sure changed on you, hasn't she, Jason? He's saying that. He was driving a Porsche and a Mercedes when he met his wife, and a regular No Driving Gloves listener. And she had no clue what they were. Tell her husband or her cousin, her husband asked, her cousin asked whose Porsche was in the driveway. And, it, you know, but now Dana seems to be a car person. So I don't know if that was Jason or if that was her listening to No Driving Gloves. But we wanted to jump because Jason asked a question earlier and we said we'd hit it in the last quarter of the show. And where did I put that question? Because I kind of want to have the correct wording on how he asked it. I said, we can address that tonight. There's this jealous statement. He was just basically asking, thinking about the cars you guys own and those that you would like to realistically buy, would you opt for spending twice as much for a car because it had a bigger engine? For example, a Corvette, $20,000, or a Corvette Z06 for $40,000, a Cadillac XLR for $15,000, or an XLRV for $30,000. Is it really necessary to pay so much more for a bigger engine? Derek, of course, asks, are all the other factors the same? Condition, mileage. And we're going to go with condition, mileage. All the other factors are the same. The difference is, I'm going to say trim level, whether it be the V or the Z06 or, you know, the Mustang GT over an EcoBoost Mustang or so on. I think, well, back in when I was buying cars, my dad always insisted I have air conditioning in cars. For your younger listeners, yes, there was a point in time that air conditioning was an option on your car. And dad always said it helped the resale value. Well, you pay $800 more for air conditioning when you buy the car, you get that percentage more back when you sell the car. If you don't buy the air conditioning in the car, you don't get that percentage more back. So it's, if you buy the smaller engine for half the price, the car's probably going to maintain a similar ratio of value to the bigger motor car. And the bigger motor car is always going to be the most desirable. It's still going to be the one that makes the headlines. It's going to be the one that go, you've got a Cadillac CTS wagon, but boy, you really should have the CTS-V wagon with a 6-speed. Well, yeah, but that's going to cost you $70,000 in today's market, or a Cadillac CTS wagon is going to cost you $30,000 maybe. Numbers are abstract. I have not looked up pricing. But if you only got $30,000 and you want the wagon, that's what you've got to do. If you got $70,000, you could buy the $30,000 wagon and buy something else. Or do you want to be able to be that person? You know, you're going to get your money back out of either one in the long run, I think. But it's just really what you want to do with the car, in my opinion. What's your thoughts, Derek?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing, John. You know, to me, it comes down to, well, number one, I'm jealous that the cars you guys are, you know, vying after have different engine options, because all the ones I go after all have, you know, one or two cylinder engines. You don't get an option. To me, it's the same. It's exactly it. It's what do you want the car for? What what is drawing you to that vehicle? You know, is it just the styling? Is it just that you want to own the car because it looks so great and, you know, you just want to drive it around and feel good in it? Then, you know, the small engine, the low base model package, whatever you want to call it, to me is good. I mean, because you care, you know, if you're after that, you care about, you know, parking it, walking away, looking back and smiling because you love the style and the look of that car. Now, if you want the car because it's a high performance machine, like a Z06 or a, you know, any of the other high performance, you know, Mustangs out there, you know, Ferrari, whatever car it is, then yeah, you're going to be, you know, you're in it because you want the speed and the performance, and you're likely somebody that's maybe going to take it out on track and you want that engine. So to me, it comes down to, you know, what do you want the car for? More so than the value, right? Because John, like you said, you know, okay, you get a base model of something and somebody else gets the top of the line package, you know, base Corvette, Z06 Corvette. And 20 years from now, if you paid half the value of the Z06 for the base model, likely in about 20 years, it's going to hold a similar ratio. So to me, you know, the money side of it, it's like you said, John, you're going to get back what you put into it and how well you maintain it. And when it comes to making the decision between, you know, the packages that are on it, to me, that's personal preference. It comes down to what is drawing you to that vehicle, which aspect of the vehicle is what you are seeking it out for. So yeah, I think I agree with you, John. I mean, it just comes down to that personal preference. And, you know, there are the rare occasions where, you know, you know, cars are investments. They're a gamble, especially when you're dealing with collector vehicles. And sometimes there's one that you pick the right one, and man, in 25 years from now, it is the most sought after car and no one would have saw it coming. So, you know, to me, get it because you like it and get the vehicle that you like the best and go from there. Because, you know, if you get it at the right rate, right price when you buy it today, like you said, John, you know, it's going to hold that value. You maintain it, you care for it, and, you know, do what you got to do. In 20, 25 years, you know, you're going to be able to see, you know, the value in it. So yeah, I think that's kind of where the conversation, you know, heads with this topic, but that's just mine and John's take on it. I mean, anybody else that's watching tonight, jump in the comments and tell us what you think.
I think I'm going to get Sean to jump into the comments here because I'm going to give two real world examples of this. Sean at one time owned a Mini Cooper also. But he had the, you know, base model. It wasn't an S. It wasn't a John Cooper Works. It wasn't anything special, you know. But to him, it was the greatest car. And he was fast as hell on an autocross course with this base model Mini Cooper. One of my ex-girlfriends, base model Mini Cooper. Very, very happy with it. Happy enough that when she bought her daughter a Mini Cooper, also another base model Mini Cooper. Me, I wanted a little bit more out of mine, so I bought an S. And I know what I wanted to pay. An S presented itself in that price range, so I bought a Mini Cooper S. Did I buy a John Cooper Works? I couldn't see spending the extra money. Now, when I had the engine issue in the Mini and they replaced the motor, I did inquire about maybe bumping it up to a John Cooper Works spec, but that was going to be a nightmare. So we just went ahead and put an S motor back into it. And do I want a Mini Cooper GP 1, 2, 3? No, I don't need that. The Mini Cooper S will get me in enough trouble. I don't need the John Cooper Works package to say I have the John Cooper Works package. It's what you want to pay for. I know, like I said, Sean was happy with his base model Mini Cooper. The ex was happy with her base model Mini Coopers. I wanted a little bit more, so I got the S because that's what, like I said, was available, and I didn't choose to go higher. On the same thing, if you're going out and you're buying a brand new Ferrari, you can buy the SF90 if you've got enough money to do it. That's the one to have. You know, the SF90XX is